Well, of course, many people feel that American policy toward Cuba or toward Latin America in general is morally bankrupt. And then there are huge numbers who support our leaders in whatever they choose to do. And there are those who say, well, the law is the law, whether I agree with it or not. We can't have a country where you only obey the laws you like. And the polls go this way, and the polls go that way.
But the polls break it down like courtroom drama. Yes, no, innocent, guilty, squeezing people into the radical simplifications of reality that pass for present-day politics. I mean, the greatest sin of a politician is to waffle on an issue, even worse, to change his mind. And you're supposed to have an opinion and stick to it like my uncle trying to ride the pig. But when we're talking more than 5 seconds to human beings, they start sounding very strange. They start sounding like human beings.
We chronicled a trip to Cuba, so we thought, well, how about a trip from Cuba? Opposite directions, but not entirely opposite people. This is Rafael Torres.
The losing side of a war or a social struggle has its own stories to tell, but we don't often hear them. Rafael Torres is 63, lives in Florida. He's a photographer, spent most of his life as a cartographer, before that working multiple jobs to raise a family of six. At the age of 21, he left Cuba after the invasion attempt at the Bay of Pigs.
Prior to that, in 60, I actually worked for the Cuban government, for the government of Fidel Castro, which at that time was not known to be communist. I worked as a something similar, it was called Comandos Rurales, in which, you know, young people go into the countryside to help educate and teach the people in the countryside that do not know how to read and write, and also help them. So I was very much into the socialistic mentality at the time. I was very young, of course, and very passionate and very idealistic. And to some degree, those were the best years for me because I was doing something for the love of it, you know, for the passion of it, not just for myself. They pay us very little amount of money just to be able to stay alive. Fidel Castro took over the Cuban government in the end of 1959. So in 1960, that's literally when the revolution started. 60 to 61 was a great year. We were very passionate because it was for a change in the way politics is done in Latin America. And I'll be very honest with you, I wish it would stay that way. We could have been a great social experiment. I really believe that we had a unique opportunity to show not only our people in Cuba, but also the rest of Latin America, maybe even the third world, that you can have a social revolution that is based upon equality and distribution of wealth. That was my beginning. My beginning was very socialistic minded. But I got involved with people in the, I became a Catholic at the age of 15. And it was, my father was a communist, by the way. And so I mean, there was no, you know, crucifix on the wall, any of those things in my house. But my mother and him divorced when I was 15. And as a result, my mother wanted me to have some kind of a different kind of mentality. And I met some of the people that really were working at the highest, deepest level in the counter-revolution, right there in that church. And all those people either were killed or were gone, exiled. But I was just right there. I was just a kid. It just happened to be at the right time or the right place. All these people were very, I didn't know this at the time, but they were actually working against the Batista government, which was a dictator. So there was a lot of politics and what you call Christian democracy, not just religion per se. Sort of like an avant-garde type of, you know, priesthood in which, you know, they don't just want to convert you to religion, but also they want to change the present state of things. By the time I turned 19 and 20, then, of course, the major cataclysmic changes in Cuba took place. And by that time, my mentality had, on one side, there was this strong spirituality, very, very, very much motivated by Christian justice. And on the other side, there was a desire to, you know, when you're young, you think you can do anything and everything. So that's why I volunteered to go up in those mountains and help teach. But for about a year or so, it was just like a love affair with the idea that we could change. We could really change the way things have been done for centuries. The church had a great deal of pull in the way I thought. And of course, you know, once the two sides began to really be drawn, then I could only take one side. And to me, it was the spiritual side. So basically, I opposed my father and my brother, which was also a member of the Cuban government. And so it was, you know, the sad part about this situation is that not only was it a political thing, but it was also like you had in this country, it was a civil war in which people that have the same blood will basically split across ideology, you know, and it was really very tragic. So when I began to get involved with the clandestine movement, you know, then what I didn't know was we were very carefully watched. And me being young and inexperienced, I didn't really know that many of the things that I was saying, discussing with friends were being recorded and kept. So my brother was a member of the what they call the G2, which is the intelligence section of the Cuban government. And in order for him to prove his loyalty to the government, he was one of the ones that came looking into the house where I was living right before the Bay of Pigs. And he came and he knocked at the door. My in-laws tell me this because I left that house like 5 hours before he got there. Serendipity. Or maybe the good Lord just pulled me out. You know, he said, you know, we were supposed to leave and concentrate in a certain part of the island before the actual invasion took place.
Rafael's job for the invasion was to be part of a group of saboteurs to cut phone lines and blow up bridges. I asked him, did you have a clear sense of what you were involved in?
Hell no. Do you think anybody knows anything about 20? No, but I really believed that, and quite frankly, I really thought that what we were doing was the right thing to do, and I was willing to do whatever was necessary. That's what I meant by putting your spirituality to work. I was willing to risk my life in what I believe. What I didn't know then, and I know now, is that, you know, unfortunately, those things were discussed and decided in Washington, not in Havana. And we receive orders through our cells. We were organizing cells, and each cell was no more than 5 or 6 individuals. And you didn't need to know their names. We all knew each other by code names. So the head of my cell contacted me in person. Nothing was done over phones because we knew the phones were tapped. And he told me, gave me the instruction. He said, on this day, I need you to be in this city. And in contact, he gave me a little piece of red cloth that was cut in a rather peculiar shape. And he said, go to this dentist's office in this street, in this city, and walk in there and ask for a dental appointment. When you're inside and there's no one around, just pull out of your pocket this little piece of red cloth and just play with it with your hands. Don't say anything. And if this person is who he is, he will see that. And if he will not say anything to you, he will also go and get a little piece of red cloth and the two of them should match. Then you know you have your contact. That was kind of, you know, like very James Bond-esque. But it really happened. These things really did happen. It was very cool. scary as hell, but it was cool. And so, you know, at that time, I just got married. And my wife, which was very loving and very silly, managed to be convinced that she should go with me and do these things. But strangely enough, it was one of the best things because we risked our lives together, but we also left Cuba together. And by the way, we were armed. We all carried, you know, weapons and not, you know, Uzis or anything like that, but we always carried, you know, pistol or something like that. And at that time in Cuba, if you were caught with a revolver or a pistol and you were not a member of the government, that was enough reason to be put away. So, you know, here we are, 20 years old, just, you know, carrying a piece, you know. I remember that the dentist gave me the piece of cloth and then he began profusely to sweat. And of course, you know, we're not saying anything. Nobody's saying a word. And he just signals me out. He said, just come over here. And he took me out, and I met two young people that looked just as scared as I was, I guess. And he said, these people have also come to have their teeth, you know, clean or fixed, whatever. And they all had the little pieces of cloth, you know. But someone had, obviously someone in the government, the Cuban government, had been infiltrating this group, and they had cut half of them. So the dentist knew that it was only a matter of time before somebody would be knocking at his door. So he wanted us to leave there as soon as possible. And I asked him, where the hell are we going to go? I have no place to go. So he sort of like said, well, he told the two guys to go to this place. And then he told my wife and I, he felt sorry for us, I guess, to go to a safe house. So we went to a safe house and goes, you know, the streets were, this was like days before the invasion. So the government intelligence forces were everywhere, in hotels, in bus stations, train stations. Anyway, we stayed in a hotel overnight, and the guy that was in the hotel was supposed to be one of the members of this cell, but he wasn't there when we got there. So we went to sleep. The next morning, my wife and I come down, and the guy sees us on the lobby, and he just points upwards like that. And of course, at that time, you're very weary of all the things. We go upstairs, and he rushes, another sweaty guy rushes up into the room and says, "You must leave right now through the back door. Someone has seen you here, and they call the local authorities, and they'll be here in minutes. So leave now." So I cannot tell you where to go. Just get the hell out of here. So I remember my wife and I left through the back door. And as we did, we saw these dark police vehicles, come over in the front. And, it's not like the movies, really was. We sneak out. So I said to her, "Where the hell, how do we get out of this town, alive?" So we went to the bus station to get out of town. And, of course, the bus station is full of cars. And we got two tickets. We got the ticket, and I said to her, something told me in the back of my head, I said, "Don't just stay here at the bus station." It's like I heard a voice. I said, "You got the tickets, get out of the bus station." We did. We went across the street, remembered clearly as if it was yesterday. We went to have a cup of coffee, and then the two black cars pulled in front of the bus station, just as we left across the street. And they went there, and I could easily see them asking the ticket seller, and the guy sort of looking around like, "Oh, I think they went that way." I didn't hear it, but I could see him pointing. So the two cars left, and it happened to be that the bus just happened to pull into the bus station. And we got in the bus, and with our two little tickets sat there, and of course, we had guns with us. So, if they had stopped the bus and searched the bus. But this is another one of those wonderful things. The bus did not have any, it was like an extra bus. It was not supposed to stop at that place. There was another bus supposed to stop in there. So what happens, as we were leaving the city, there was a blockade outside of the city waiting to inspect, anything that was looking suspicious. They were looking for people like us. But I still remember, I was looking at my wife, and I reached inside the bag, and I'm holding this pistol. I said, "We're not going to be taken alive. I can tell you that right now. No way." Because I heard about horrible things happen to people. And so I said, "At least we'll take a couple of these fools with us, So I remember when they pull over, and the guy who was one of the, you might say, the secret police people, he looked at the bus, and then he sees the sign. The bus was not supposed to be one of the ones. So it's he signals to the bus, "Just keep going." In other words, he assumed that this bus never stopped. So talk about, having a guardian angel, So we left, and, from there on, we were on the run for 3 months in Cuba. We always managed to find a place to hide, and some kind, loving person that took risks, keeping people like us in their houses. And 3 months later, some members of our family managed to get us into a boat. We were lost in for 3 days drifting. And we thought we had drifted because we left in the south of Cuba. So we thought we had drifted back to Cuba. And one of the members of our crew said, "I think we're back in Cuba." And let me show you another bit of serendipity. We have, because we couldn't take all the fuel that we wanted or could use, we took just barely enough to navigate for maybe a day. But then again, we ran out of fuel. But one person in the boat said, "We need to save 1 gallon of fuel." I don't know why this person said that. And you know why? When we got to this key, we saw this lighthouse, and somebody was on top of the mast looking down. We'd been like, "Oh, darn it, look at that. We have reefs all around that place." We thought we were safe, and there was nothing but you could see the ocean breaking over the reefs. I said, "Oh, heck, how the hell are we going to get through that?" So he said, "There's an area that looks kind of dark. Maybe there's a passage through there." All right. So we're saying, okay, so we were sailing, we were drifting, and somebody said, "Let's put that gallon of fuel back in the tank, see if the engine restarts." And he did. So we managed with that 1 gallon of fuel to navigate through this tiny little passage, no wider than maybe, I would say, about 25 feet. With this 20-foot wide boat right through there. I could see the edges of the coral as we just went by. And when we got there, we had no idea where we were. One of the guys who was leading this group was a Cuban army lieutenant of rebel army. And I remember they told us to lay low, and I was on my back. And I remember watching him, and then the guy who's holding the wheel, I said, "Oh, darn it, I think we're in Cuba. These people have uniforms." And the guy next to me, I watch him just cock his Uzi, and I said, "Oh, hell, that's how he's going to end up in here." So when we arrived at this dock, there was these two men in uniform, and we jumped and aimed the guns at them, but nobody fired. And it turned out to be these people were Mexican Navy officers. That's a good part about it. So coming to this country was both a blessing, but also was a disappointment because we wanted to stay in Mexico. And but as it turned out to be, it was the best thing ever happened to us because this is where I raised my family and became an American citizen. Here's another thing. I did not want to become an American citizen, which everybody does, because I still have loyalty to my country. I really wanted to go back to Cuba. And for 10 years, I thought we would go back. And I said, you know, I want to go back as a Cuban. But when I realized that we were never going to go back, at least I won't be going back, you know, I began to realize this is my home. This is where I live. And you know, I have been treated here better than any place else. No, we were really, after the Bay of Pigs, we were really the first few stragglers to survive that mess. And there were people in Miami that had been part of the previous government. And that's one of the reasons why I left Miami. I didn't want to be around the Batistianos. So we decided that we would just, you know, just, I wanted to go to Alaska, believe it or not. I thought it would be great to move to Alaska and be, at that time they were still having homesteading, you know. It'd be great to have our own place, you know, our own piece of land in Alaska. My wife said, you're crazy. You don't know anything about snow and winter. You don't know nothing about that. So, but I said, yeah, we got to go to Alaska, you know. So we ended up in Pittsburgh. Well, now why Pittsburgh? I have no idea. It sounded interesting. You know, I went to Pittsburgh because why not? But I wanted to go to Alaska. We never looked back. We only look forward. So we decided that what we should do is to, if we are going to be here, let's live here. Let's stay here. Let's make the best of the situation. And one of the decisions that we made was to speak English at home. But I still clearly remember when I became an American. It was in a dream. Because the dream was in English. It was the first time I ever dreamt in English. I realized that my subconscious was telling me, this is where you belong.
And with that, we skipped lightly over 40 years of living and change to the present moment, sitting in our dining room in Sebastopol on a visit with his son, who's been sitting in on the interview, and later asks, hey, could I get a copy of the whole interview because there are things I've never heard, and it's different when your dad is telling it to somebody else.
So my thinking at that time was, you know, I lost Cuba, I lost my family, I lost my brother, he betrayed me. And therefore, the only thing I can control is my family. And I don't mean control like you think in normal terms, but influence is a better word. And I influence them by, I try to raise my children as I wish I had been raised myself. I used to remember the adventures I used to have with my grandfather. He used to take us exploring caves and you know, looking for frogs in the fields. And I said, I can do that for my kids. And I did. We really were living a very poor life, but my children don't remember that. They remember all the great fun and joy that we used to have together, and all these little adventures that we used to have together. You know, material things were important only in that whatever was necessary to, you know, to do life, but nothing extra. There really was not much extra. To this day, I still have no idea, why am I here? Why did I survive all those things? And I feel like I'm actually reading the script of my life as it's presented to me. Sometimes it's just that simple. What is going to happen next? You know, my life is that way. I have no idea what the hell I'm going to do next. But I'm going to find out tomorrow. Or actually, I'm going to find out today, because we only live in today's, you know, moment of time. There is no tomorrow. There's no yesterday. You ask me all these questions. You know, you have no idea. How long ago anybody asked me, you know, what did I think about Cuba and coming here? Because I do not dwell on the past. A lot of people live in the past. My families are still dealing with things that happened 20, 40, 50 years ago. I'm only happy if I can make it to this day. This is the only thing over which I have control, this moment. That's all I have. I don't even have medical insurance. I believe that whatever happens to me is okay. That's the reason why I don't watch news. I do not believe that I need to be afraid of anything or anybody. And all the news do is make you be afraid. You know, when I was in Cuba, we were afraid. The Boogaboo was a communist, you know. And, of course, you know, I risked my life for that reason. If I had not been afraid of the communists, who knows what my life would have turned to. You know, and later on, many years later, you know, in this country, I was afraid of being poor. Well, so I worked 2 or 3 jobs. Well, so I was poor. It wasn't the end of the world. It was fine. And then now I'm 63 years old, early retired, because I cannot get employment again in my field. My field has literally disappeared, has become automated. So I don't worry about it anymore. You know, I every day I go out there, and if I meet someone interesting, I say, you know, maybe this is a person that I need to meet today. I truly believe that I'm not going to speak of a God or a deity, but I do believe that there is a universal intelligence. That's, I'm sure you have heard that before. And I really believe that the longer I live. And that intelligence is really benevolent. I really don't believe the world is getting worse, exactly, except in the freeway, of course. But I sense that part of what I'm doing here is to learn. And my whole life I've been a process of learning. But also I have renounced a lot of the thinking that I used to have when I was much younger. Not because it was bad. It was useful to me at that time. But I see the world now differently. I don't watch television news anymore. I don't read newspapers anymore. This may sound bizarre for somebody who was a political refugee. I honestly don't believe that most of the stuff is true. Because I saw the way it was projected when I was young in Cuba and then later in this country. And it's all carefully edited, carefully organized, and carefully prepared to change the thinking of the people, the masses. I saw many things in person that never, ever were told the way they happened, be it by the communists or even by the American government. So, you know, I have a sense, I was once a rabid anti-communist. I'm not anymore. I don't believe in that stuff anymore. So if I can change, then I think the Jews can change, the Palestinians can change, the Iraqis can change, and definitely the Americans can change. But, you know, whether we live long enough for that, I don't know. I really believe that people can change, yes. I have a proof of that.
In Sebastopol, California, we were talking with Rafael Torres. If you'd like to experience an entirely different aspect of Rafael, his photography, you can email suburbanexplorer@aol.com. He sends out regular email with extraordinary digital photographs.
And send us your stories. Visit our website, www.hitching.org, and enter our story contest and read some stories and listen to our past shows and our CD anthologies and think about buying some as gifts to your friends or yourself. You can sample them all there. They're really, really good. www.hitching.org.
And our show next month. Well, right now we're in the middle of a big project with a theater in Boston, and we think we'll be doing a show about that show, Search for the Lost City.
What city is the lost city? Just about all of them. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye. And a repeat from last month, we have received new support, $10,000 from the National Endowment for the Arts, to keep us on the air, and that means we have to match it dollar for dollar. So in the coming months, we're giving a series of Hitchhiker's House Parties to raise money and friends with our live performance and talk and socializing. So if you'd like to bring us live and breathing into your living room and invite your friends or receive an invitation, email us info@hitching.org. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller. Peace and joy.
Because one of the reasons why I did this was because I felt that a person needs to give more of himself to the world, you know, in order to be able to really make his spiritual beliefs real. A lot of people are into spirituality, but the way they live their lives is an exact opposite of what they say that they do. You know, there's a lot of so-called spirituality, but it's not manifest. Even on the way people drive on the road, I don't see the spirituality on the road. I don't see it anywhere, to be honest with you. But, you know, that's my opinion.
It's not spiritual driving, I get the